The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming to the kickoff event of the Fall 2009 Author Series. I think we've got a terrific series this year, and I hope we'll be seeing more of you. Interviewing Sam Tannenhaus will be Carlin Romano, the literary critic and at times book editor of The Inquirer for 25 years, from 1984 to earlier this year. Carlin is now the critic at large of the Chronicle of Higher Education in Washington, and he teaches media theory and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. He was, in 2006, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Criticism for his regular essays in the Chronicle. Carlin Romano.
Hello. How's everybody? So we're going to have some fun tonight, I think. I did want to say first, for those of you who don't know, this is actually an endowed lecture. The Mila Gordon Memorial Lecture was established in honor of Mila Gordon, who taught business skills to special education children at the Widener Memorial School and pursued lifelong learning and brought her daughters, grandchildren, and friends to share her love of the free library. I think her daughter, Toby Dichter, is here somewhere. Toby, hi. Yeah, thank you. And we honor your mother tonight. Sam Tannenhaus, some of you know, some of you may not know, that he is the editor of the New York Times Book Review and the Week in Review. You can see how much work is being dumped on journalists these days. I was thinking, maybe there'll finally be four editors at every paper and they'll all have six sections to do. Let me give you a little bit of his biography from the book. Sam Tannenhaus, in addition to being the editor of both of those sections from 1999 to 2004, he was a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where he wrote often on politics. His work has also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the New Republic, the New York Review of Books, and many other publications. His previous book, Whitaker Chambers, a biography, won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. And I just want to say, as a longtime book editor and critic down the road, it's really the first time since, I would say, decades ago when John Leonard edited the New York Times Book Review that we have a real intellectual and writer who has his hands on the control of the New York Times Book Review. And I think that's great. There are a lot of bad things going on in journalism, but I think book reviews should be run by thinkers and writers and intellectuals, literary people, and that's the situation now. So please join me in welcoming Sam Tannenhaus.
Like an enormous watch fob, but I guess we're okay, right? Uh-huh. Sounds like we're projecting.
In case you try to run away, you are pulled back by that string. Sure. And I should say to everybody, we're going to talk for about 30 minutes up here, and then we're going to open it up to questions, mainly going to talk about the book, but I thought I'd ask Sam some questions, too, about the Times Book Review and the issues that come up in editing a book review today. Many of you know that book journalism, literary journalism, is collapsing in many places. Thank God not at the Times. But I want to start, and I will pull things out of the book for you, Sam, by having you explain a little bit the different sorts of conservatives that you have in mind. And early in the book, Sam writes, conservatives today remain strangely apart, trapped in the irrelevant causes of another day, deaf to the actual conversation unfolding across the land in its cities and towns, in red and blue states, in the sanctuaries of the privileged and tented Bushvilles. And then a little later, he has a wonderful sentence that everybody is quoting, because it is a wonderful sentence. Today's conservatives resemble the exhumed figures of Pompeii, trapped in postures of frozen flight, clenched in the rigor mortis of a defunct ideology. Woo. Now, applause for the single line.
And I'm a guy who's been writing, biographies of conservatives for 20 years, so it's not easy to write those words.
Yeah. So when you're thinking of conservatism and conservatives, is it a diverse group? There are many different types of conservatives. Some you like, some you don't.
Well, what this book does, and I should say, first of all, it's narrative. It's really the distillation of work I really have been doing for 20 years. First, the biography of Whitaker Chambers. And for about a decade now, I've been working on a biography of William F. Buckley. And these are two very large, complicated figures who were first and foremost intellectuals and literary men of real accomplishment. And so what occurred to me as I was looking at our political landscape right now is that I don't see people like that anymore. And so essentially what the book does, it grows out of an essay I wrote in the New Republic, I think it was published in February, right after Obama took office. And it was already clear that a certain noisy, aggressive opposition was in place. And it's interesting because some of the responses to the book, particularly in the ideological right, have sort of rebuked me for being premature in criticizing conservatism. But in fact, it seems to me all we've seen in recent days confirms the premise of the book, the thesis, which is that there are really two conservative strains in the modern American tradition. And this book is narrative. It begins at the beginning with the rise of conservatism as a movement in the United States, really going back, believe it or not, to the Great Depression, but really taking shape as a forceful philosophy and political ideology in the first world years of the Cold War, about more than half a century ago, that there are two strains. And I define them, one as a realistic form of conservatism, which is descended from the great philosophers of modern conservatism. First, Edmund Burke, the great Scottish member of Parliament and really thinker on the right, who set forth the idea of conservatism in reaction to the revolutionary events of his day, which mainly the French Revolution, in which he saw sort of pure-minded ideologues, children of the Enlightenment, who'd taken a series of abstract ideas, Enlightenment ideas, and really wanted to impose them on an entire society, France. And Burke's objection was not so much with their goals. Obviously, the Ancien Régime in France was a corrupt monarchy that needed to be modernized. What he objected to was the idea that everything would be destroyed, that was really the idea, the vision of the Robespierres and Dantons. You'd tear everything down. And he didn't understand why instead they didn't try to conserve what was good and useful in the society and correct everything else. And those were the two principles he laid out, to conserve and to correct. That's why I say in this book, the nearest we have to, in my view, to a conservative politician in this definition now is our president. He has diminished the power of the presidency. He's opposed to the imperial presidency. He is very aware that while we have a greatly damaged economy, it will best be repaired through a kind of partnership of government and free enterprise. These are very traditional classical ideas. That's one kind of conservatism. But there's another kind of conservatism which I call revanchist. And it sounds like a kind of arcane term because it really applies historically to 19th century Europeans who wanted to reclaim lands or parts of countries they had lost during wars. But it seemed to me that mentality is what describes or defines what we now think of as conservatives. That is, a group of people, both intellectuals and journalists on the one hand and political figures on the other, who want to take back the culture, who want to wrest America away from its usurpers and from the enemies within who have taken over the government, which is more or less how they portray the Democrats and particularly the president. And I point out in the book the epithets used by many on the right against Obama now do not merely resemble those that arch conservatives made against Franklin Roosevelt in the first days of the New Deal. They echo them verbatim. Herbert Hoover accused Franklin Roosevelt of being alternately a fascist and a communist who would lead America down the road to socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the origin of what I call the revanchist strain in conservatism. And what the book traces is the constant battle between these two. So a president like Eisenhower is, in my view, a kind of classically conservative president. Why? Because he followed five successive terms of democratic leadership, and he saw that the great innovation of his predecessors, the Franklin Roosevelt and then Harry Truman, was the New Deal, and that Americans liked it. They were used to the New Deal. It had been woven into the fabric of our politics. So the answer is not to roll it back or destroy it. It's to find a Republican way to govern under the New Deal. So that's one kind of conservative. Another, the other conservative president I single out, which surprises everyone, is Bill Clinton. Why Clinton? Well, Clinton was elected as a liberal Democrat, but he succeeded three Republican presidencies, two of Reagan, third George H.W. Bush, and Clinton came into office thinking he might be a new Kennedy or Johnson, and he would return our politics to the kind of high idealism of the early 1960s. What did he find? He found that the unleashed market forces of the Reagan period had more or less become the shared doctrine of the public. So he adjusted. Mm-hmm. That's what, to my mind, the great conservatives do, is to adjust to political reality. So those are the realists.
Mm-hmm.
And the book traces how, over the past 60 or 70 years, these two different visions have been in conflict, sometimes within individual figures. A president like Nixon, for instance, was both a revanchist and a realist. Reagan had these qualities too. And there's one other piece to the book, and this will lay it out, and then we can have a real conversation, is the centerpiece in this narrative is actually about the failures and excesses of great society liberalism. And I mention that because, particularly when conservatives comment on the book, they always leave that part of it out. That it's not simply a book about conservatism. There's also another conflict going on between Democrats and Republicans. And there, I argue, following, I think, to my mind, the greatest conservative writer of our time, Gary Wills, who strangely reviewed the book in the New York Review of Books, which is an odd feeling when, you know, your hero quarrels with you, although it's a very generous review. But what Wills, as a very young man, pointed out was the two conflicting larger trends in our politics is between consensus on the one hand and orthodoxy on the other. And Democrats have, by and large, governed by consensus. Kennedy and Johnson were very much attached to consensus. Clinton was. I think Obama wants to be. The other side is orthodoxy. And if there are Catholics in the audience, the rectoratio, right reason, it's the title of one of Bill Buckley's books, that orthodoxy should trump consensus. Staying true to your ideals is more important than finding a compromise. And so that's the other sort of conflict that the book describes. So that's the narrative. It's done through the writers and political figures.
Knowing Sam for a long time, he doesn't always answer every question at that length, but you really need this kind of overview to understand what's going on. I mean, one question I had, you know, with the title of the book, whether it was your title or you argued about it, because obviously there's a sort of conservatism that you want to survive and flourish, an intellectually rigorous one, a self-critical one. Is the title itself something that's more meant to be provocative than strictly accurate?
Well, you know, it's almost a kind of hypothesis. When the New Republic article appeared, that it was given this very dramatic title, Conservatism is Dead. But this is more about the proposition of the death of conservatism. Might we be facing a time when conservatism as a really vital contributing part of our national discussion has reached its terminus? That's really what it's about. And so that's why there's so much history in the book. Go back and see who the great thinkers and writers were and what made them so valuable, and how can we recover that? Because I think as liberals, too, pay a price when we don't have a really strong, vibrant conservatism.
Yeah, no, I would say as a critic, one of the really strong parts of the book is the way Sam weaves together current policy choices and some of the predilections we might have expected of the great conservative thinkers like Disraeli. I liked in the book, you know, where even someone like Russell Kirk at one point was thinking of school lunch programs as the advent of totalitarianism.
Yes.
But Disraeli would, I think, have been on the side of school lunch programs, as you say. But there's a whistleblower aspect to the book, it seems to me, that a lot of conservatives would feel like Sam is saying these things. I mean, wasn't he in some respect on our side or respectful of our side? As you work through this book, I mean, there's a passion in it, a passion for getting rid of the extremist, dopey, flamboyant, cable-type approach to these issues. Were you thinking, gee, am I going to like lose some friends in doing this? Am I going to estrange people that I respect? Or it's actually important for me as a critic to blow the whistle on what's going on in conservatism?
Well, you know, once you take over the job as editor of the New York Times Book Review, you don't have any friends.
Anyway.
You know this very well. There are people who like you at a certain moment. Someone told me when I started this job, she said, it was a deputy at the time, Julie Just, and she said, you'll know who your friends are the day you leave this job.
Right.
So I don't really worry so much about that. It's true there is some commentary in it about the kind of, you know, the cable TV aspect of conservatism. But really what worries me more, this book is also a kind of lament, is that the intellectuals have kind of given up the game on the right. That there's a great passage I quote. The best things in this book are my quotations of other people. And a very brilliant, interesting ex-conservative writer, Michael Lind, said something that comes up in some of the interviews I do, where I quote him saying, 10 years ago, the most respected voice on the right was George Will, and now it's Rush Limbaugh. And I tell people whenever that comes up, Mike Lind wrote that in 1995. It was already a problem then. And what happened is the serious-minded conservatives lost their perspective on what their role should be. There's a story I tell in the book that I think is really important. It's about William F. Buckley and his transformation. Buckley, when he was very young, was a real flamethrower. You know, his second book was called McCarthy and His Enemies. His first book was an attack on his alma mater, Yale University. He wanted socialists, you know, dismissed from the faculty and all the rest. But then in the 1960s, he grew up. And he grew up because of all the serious disorder and disharmony that had happened in the culture. And meanwhile, what I describe is how Whittaker Chambers, my first biographical subject, who was a mentor to Buckley, much older than Buckley. Chambers was then in his middle 50s, and Buckley was not yet 30, founding National Review. And Chambers told him, the right is going nowhere until it gets a grasp on historical reality. And what he meant by that was, the New Deal is here to stay. And how did Chambers know that? He was a farmer in Maryland. And all these very conservative farmers who worked with him were standing in line waiting for their price supports and government payouts. And Chambers said, they have voted for socialism with their feet, so you better find another argument to make. Well, and Buckley resisted all of this, but he revered Chambers, and Chambers was brought into the fold. Well, then in the 1960s, after Chambers had died, we had this period of tremendous disruption in our culture. The Vietnam War really helped tear the country apart. There's tremendous racial discord as the civil rights movement migrated from the Jim Crow South to the de facto North, and racial protest took on a different character, and people got scared to death, and nobody knew where the country was going. And so that's when conservatism changed from being this revanchist, let's drive the communists out of government, to we're the ones who will help keep the society together. Mm-hmm. And Buckley picked up his cue from one of the great liberal Democrats of the era, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Moynihan gave a famous speech in Washington before the Americans for Democratic Action, the ADA, the great liberal organization. And Moynihan said this in 1967. He said, look, a lot is going wrong in this country. And like it or not, we liberals have to accept some of the blame for it because we've been running the show for a long time now. And so you can't just point to the other side. So he said, now it's time for liberals to make common cause with responsible Republicans who share a belief in, quote, the politics of stability, unquote, which came directly from Edmund Burke. And Bill Buckley, who was then probably the most widely read conservative columnist in America, and some 300 papers, back when there were 300 newspapers, syndicated a column. Buckley wrote a column, he reported on what Moynihan said, and then he said, and then he wrote, anything we conservatives can do to help, just holler. In other words, the lifeline was thrown out, and he grasped it. That's what we don't see today. And now let me add one more incident, again involving Buckley. In 1968, many here will remember, Lyndon Johnson was a president losing a war in Vietnam. His popularity was sinking. But he was actually still by far the front runner to be reelected. The economy was very strong. Then he was challenged, you remember, by Eugene McCarthy in the New Hampshire primary. And Johnson won, but he won by so little, he won by 5 or 7 percentage points, that he decided just to bail, that he would not seek reelection. This was the moment for conservatives to say, we will win the next election, which they did, and we've been proved right. We have been vindicated because the author of The Great Society, who 2 years before had been described as the most powerful, successful president in American history, had now gone down in flames, and we should triumph. But that's not what Buckley wrote in his column. What Buckley said instead was, some people may take pleasure in this, in Johnson deciding not to seek re-election. He said, but to a Burkean like myself, Bill Buckley, the idea that carloads of students should drive across from Massachusetts to New Hampshire to vote in a primary when most of them in a poll didn't even know where McCarthy stood and the war in Vietnam is not good for our democracy. It's destructive of the democratic processes that are supposed to govern the land. That's when conservatism came of age. And so it's very important that readers know, readers of the book, and as we have this conversation, that there were these great periods in modern conservatism. And so I try to highlight those in the story as well.
It seemed to me, reading the book, that apart from the politics, that you have a real passionate anger against the degradation of conservative discourse and internal intellectual debate. I'll just give everybody an example. On 14, I mean, you're tough on Crystal, right? William Crystal, who was a columnist for a while.
At my newspaper,
At his own paper, so that's going to be brave. And Sam writes, these conservative intellectuals recognize no distinction between analysis and advocacy or between the competition of ideas and the naked struggle for power. To them, the Democratic Party and all manner of liberals are simply the enemy, and if the majority of the country joins the wrong side, then they are the enemy too, or its manipulated pawns. Now, one question I had, why did this, I mean, Crystal, when, I know Crystal, I remember when the Weekly Standard was founded, a lot of people of a conservative bent intellectually thought this is a good thing, here's a magazine where we're going to have a lot of high-level discourse. I agree with you that the discourse has really gone down in commentary and Weekly Standard and other places. Was it because conservatives came into power that they got too close to power and then in some kind of visceral human way got so angry about losing power that you see the decline of the rigorous argument and the revanchism you talk about? Because it is a very pronounced change.
I think that's partly it, yes. One of the interesting things about the conservative movement is it grew up at a time when conservatives were very much marginalized and excluded from the real sources of intellectual and political power. So they developed a siege mentality, and they always saw themselves as an embattled minority, even when they were running everything. So that, you know, was one of the interesting aspects of George W. Bush's presidency, that they felt besieged by the media, that they seemed to find enemies all around. Even after September 11th in particular, Bush was riding high, tremendous popularity, and all the rest. And I think one reason we saw, quite apart from the journalists, one reason we saw, you know, serious misuse of high office by George Bush was he thought if he trusted to the normal political processes, he could never get through the things he wanted. So one of the things I do in the book is distinguish between, among Republican presidents who've actually played by the rules, Eisenhower, the elder Bush, Gerald Ford. Even if you had congressional minorities, you couldn't get your legislation through, even if the court seemed hostile to you. When the law was made, you went along with it. That's your job. Mm-hmm. And the other Republican presidents, Nixon, Reagan, and the second Bush, who seemed to think government was an obstacle to their vision, which is an odd point of view for a conservative, mm-hmm. actually declare war on government and the larger society. There's a remarkable statement, an essay of Irving Kristol's, I quote, from 1975. He's identifying the enemy, the new class, as it was called. And this derives, as you know, Carl, back from the old, you know, struggles within the communist movement in the early mm-hmm. days of Stalin. We don't need to get into all of that. But he borrowed the term, the new class, became very much in vogue among conservatives in the 1970s. And Kristol says, well, what does this new class want? He says, they want power. They don't want money, they want power. And so then he says, and who constitutes this new class? You may wonder, who does it consist of? And then he gives you a list. Journalists, academics, city planners, doctors who administer Medicare, mm-hmm. Legal aid society, lawyers. It's half the society is the enemy. Mm-hmm. It's the people who actually run the country. Mm-hmm. And that's where you got this idea that even if you have the president, even if you have your majority on the Supreme Court, even if you control Congress, there are enemies all around. Mm-hmm. And that's what gave them, I think, this very aggressive, hostile rhetoric that we see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems pretty clear to me that, you know, your heroes, I wouldn't say in descending order, but, you know, Burke, Disraeli, Buckley for sure. But Buckley, because of the way he did evolve,
yes.
Shapur, that's part of what inspires you to work on him and do the biography and so on. When we have these moments that almost seem like somebody could have designed them for your publicity campaign, like the Wilson comment against Obama and so on, is the incivility of the conversation part of the problem? Is one of the things that you liked about Buckley as an exemplar of the rigorous and intellectual conservative who took opponents seriously, that he did his things with wit. He always left a good feeling on firing line, whether he had complete opponents on or not. I mean, I'm asking you about the stylistic aspects of argument within intellectual life. Is that something that
it's you very about? Important? Yeah. And it can sound trivial. I did an interview with someone. I think it was Robert Siegel in All Things Considered, and he said, "Look, aren't you really talking about class? Isn't it that you just like that Buckley had style and wit?" And or George Will does,
right.
And so
mm-hmm.
you prefer listening to them than to Rush Limbaugh. And I said, well, no, that's not really it, because politics, and I'm a great admirer of the historian Richard Hofstadter, who said that that what interested him in politics was not necessarily how institutions worked or how policy was formulated, but what he called the symbol, the symbolism of politics as part of our culture. And some of that is the way we speak to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody who's interested should go on YouTube and check out Bill Buckley's firing line interview with Noam Chomsky. And it sounds like a Monty Python parody.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but Professor Chomsky, you can't seriously mean to advance that proposition.
Uh-huh.
Oh, but Mr. Buckley, I certainly do. And, you know, much though I revere your intellect, uh-huh. it's almost comical. But and the interesting thing to remember is, and I bet you there are people in this audience who do remember, Buckley in his day was like a fire breather on firing line. And I once asked him what he thought of Bill O'Reilly, and he said, not interested. This is a bully. Well, and so why is it important? Because civil discourse is not just about how you speak, but how you listen. You know, Hannah Arendt is a great late essay she wrote on politics. You know, she was always writing about the ancient Greeks. And she has a very interesting, kind of counterintuitive essay on Socrates. And she says, you know, maybe really the measure of a great statesman is the capacity to really listen to what everyone around you says. She says, that doesn't mean you just shut up and let the other person talk. You actually empathize. You get inside their heads. One reason I wrote this book is because of the greatest modern speech in modern politics, which was delivered right here in Philadelphia, and you know which one I mean. It was Barack Obama talking about race. Why was it a great speech? not simply because he made a wonderful defense of the anxieties of African Americans. He talked about the anxieties of white people. I remember watching that speech. I was in Washington at the time. And Obama very elegantly and with great sophistication explained how the children of immigrants, as I am, you probably are, don't necessarily think they are responsible for slavery and Jim Crow segregation. Mm-hmm. He said, actually, they have their own concerns and grievances too. And my first reaction was, he knows his Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He has read all of this. He knows about the complexities of ethnic disagreement. And I thought, how is it that a guy running for president speaks in a more subtle, nuanced way about conservative philosophy than people who call themselves conservative intellectuals ever show toward any liberal idea? And so that's what made me think we had lost something. And Obama's gift, Gary Wills has written about this, is as much for listening as for speaking. Has anybody heard the audio tape of Dreams from My Father? Do you know that he does all the different voices in it?
Really?
He does the Kansas grandfather. He actually imitates them because he has an amazing ear. And that's what we have a lot of mouths in our politics and not too many ears, you know? And that aspect of civil discourse is really important.
I'm curious because you are a word person, essentially, and you've been a print person, and now you're going out there and on TV, radio, and so on. I don't know whether you've done Hannity yet or any
O'Reilly other next week.
O'Reilly next week.
Well, Laura Ingraham's radio program.
Okay, well, that will be fascinating. I mean, how, you know, I guess you're in training with the punching bag and all of that. But, you know, I mean, it's true. I mean, we go back in history. Socrates interrupted people, too. It's not like everything has always been perfectly civil.
Right.
But the switch of the culture away from print into cable, into live talk or so, does that have some effect on this so that we may be relatively well behaved in print, but somehow as the culture gets taken over by media performance, there is the degradation of argument?
I think so. Yeah. You know, there's an extraordinary thing Hofstadter wrote, and first I'm going to tell you what he said, and then I'm going to tell you when he said it. So one of the transformations in American politics is the advent of the mass media. He said, because what it's done is to create a continuous theater of politics where every single day we're living inside this kind of performance, political performance, and the spectator feels that he or she has something at stake in it and is actually a player in it. And so the spectator's private dramas get imposed on this larger public political spectacle. Mm-hmm. He wrote that in 1954 because he was thinking of the Army McCarthy hearings. So what's happened is it's gotten worse and worse and worse. I thought Henrik Hertzberg had an interesting piece. If anybody saw his political comment in this week's New Yorker, he said one of the important changes within the Republican Party, and other people have said this, Jonathan Alter said it in Newsweek, is the leaders are the Glenn Becks and the O'Reillys and the Limbaughs. No. They're not just loud voices. They were always there. Father Coughlin in the 1930s and Fulton J. Lewis and Walter Winchell. There were always people around. But they are actually delivering the marching orders. And to think it's coming out of the web or the internet, cable TV, does give one pause. Well, yeah.
I was thinking as I read your book, thinking back to the days of Buckley on TV or David Susskind on TV, you know, there were people like Joe Pyne, I don't know if you remember Joe Pyne, or Alan Burke, who were kind of off on the edge extremist, and Joe Pyne would wave his, you know, his
Mort
injury.
Downey, you remember him?
Mort Downey, but yeah, it seems like they were always considered third rank, fourth rank, and now they're running the show. Just another question or two about the book, a couple of questions about the times and how that plays into your being an author now, and then I'll open it up. You have in some of the initial reviews been attacked in likely ways, for instance in the Washington Times and the Economist, for maybe zeroing in so much on the right. And hey, what about Frank Rich in your own section? I mean, aren't there extremists on the left or one-sided writers and so on? Obviously, one can't do everything in a book. But what was your feeling about that as you focused on the damage done by extremism and superficiality in conservative intellectual rhetoric in thinking about, well, are the liberals all saintly on this? Do the liberals have their problems too?
Well, the book is about conservatism. You know, the late, great John Updike, you remember the rules of criticism he wrote all those years ago when he first began reviewing books in The New Yorker? One of them is you can't ask an author, you can't criticize an author for not writing the book you want him or her to write. This is a book about conservatism. Mm-hmm. And I have no tremendous brief for liberals. You know, I thought I would earn a little more credibility from those critics simply because I'm the guy who spent the better part of a decade writing a biography of Whittaker Chambers, which I think is, you know, a serious, consequential, mm-hmm. and respectful book, and was chosen by William F. Buckley to write his biography. So that I write as a historian of conservatism. Mm-hmm. Somebody said to me at a presentation I did in Washington, couldn't you have written a book called The Death of Liberalism? And I said, I could, but it wouldn't be as interesting. Mm-hmm. That, in a way, conservatism has dominated the landscape. So I think it's a little disingenuous for conservatives to say, what about the other guy? What about the things they've done? We know what they've done. Mm-hmm. So this is really a book that invites everyone to look at this phenomenon of conservatism and see how it's changed. The other piece I would add to that was, those same reviewers, again, ignore that the hinge, the pivotal chapter in the book, really is about the failures of what I think the political failures, not necessarily ideological or moral, because this is not really a moralistic book, of liberalism. So liberalism is dealt with in it, in its place in the historical framework. But it seems that in a short book, a short essay that looks at the inner tensions and struggles of conservatism, mm-hmm. that's where the story ought to go. So I was a little surprised by that. Something that didn't surprise me so much, though it disappointed me, is when I'm ritually identified or often identified as a spokesman for the, quote, liberal left New York Times, unquote. Huh. When, again, I've spent all this time writing about conservatism, so when I gave a talk at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, where this was a constant refrain, I said, it's very nice to be someplace where I'm called a liberal, because I'm called many things in New York, but liberal is not one of them.
Right. How weird is it to go out with a book when you are the editor of the New York Times Book Review? I mean, when you did the Chambers book, if I'm remembering right, you were an editor.
Yeah,
so this is the first time, you know, you're really out there with a new book. And we know from being in the same business, and your predecessors, Becky Sinkler, Mike Levitas, others can tell you.
And Becky Sinkler, who's been here? She's been
yeah,
college,
yeah,
right?
yeah. But exactly what you know, which is that when you eventually move on, then everything will become clear to you about your relationships and so on. But while you're in the job, right, you're one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful person in literary journalism as the rest of the world collapses. Do you think it makes any difference in the way people review your book or respond to your arguments? I mean, you were a writer and a respected intellectual before you got that job. You'll be that afterwards. But do you sense strange things because you're the Times book editor?
Actually, no. Except for the attacks on the newspaper, except mm-hmm. my employer. No, people seem, you know, they've taken a lot of shots, mm-hmm. you know, so that doesn't seem to bother them, which is good. And it's actually been good for me. I remember when the very first review of this book came in, it was a little thing in The Economist, and which I thought misrepresented the book. I remember speaking mm-hmm. to my colleagues, just, you know, we have a small group who edit the book review, and I said, you know, this guy has misrepresented my argument. He has not really described what I've done. He's faulted me for not writing the book he wanted me to write, and I've been guilty of doing that to 10 to 15 authors a week, 52 weeks of the year for 5 years now. I don't think I can complain. So in a way, it's a good experience to be out as an author again and see what it feels like to get a quibbling review or a carping review or get called a name or see somebody pull one sentence out of context when 3 sentences later I disprove the point they're accusing me of. It's actually renewed my sympathy for the author. Mm-hmm. And also, being in this job, you know this too very well, Carla. I mean, you're someone who, you know, who wrote, has written a great deal of criticism, is that when you write it, as hard as you work at it, you write it and then edit other people's criticism. I shouldn't say this, but it actually diminishes your sense of how august a profession it is mm-hmm. to write criticism. That is really people just kind of doing a job. Sometimes they do it well and not so well. And so I learned not to take the reviews as personally. That's really what I learned from this job. I'm grateful for that.
So now, dare I ask, how will the Times handle your book?
Well, the Book Review can do it. So just I'm excluded.
Boom.
Yeah, the left liberal New York Times won't review my book.
You can't go to an outsider?
Well, no. I'm a great delegator. You know, a delegator means you make everybody else do the work. And the deputy at the Book Review said, no, we don't do this. But it would seem so fraught. You send the book to some poor reviewer and he thinks, oh my God, if I don't... In most publications, they won't care, but if they're writing for the publication I edit, then you might have the difficulty of... It isn't even the problem with the review itself. It's Caesar's wife. It's the perception of the review. They think 200,000 books get published a year. 1% of them get published in the New York Times Book Review. And this jerk who's not reviewing those 99% of the other books has to have somebody review his own in the Book Review. So that was a non-starter. The Daily Times, the Daily Critics, are entirely separate from us. They have their own schedules, their own editor. They're an entirely separate operation. And there, I knew it could not possibly be reviewed by a staff critic, Michiko Kakutani, Janet Maslin, or Dwight Garner, who used to be my colleague at the Book Review, that if the Daily Paper was going to do it at all, they would go to someone outside the paper, who an authority of some kind who could review the book. But honestly, I have not asked. I don't think it's my place to inquire about that. It's just what you have to absorb. I want to be a team player. And
I'm just going to open the paper every day and see.
And hope, you know, I understand, from Random House, my publisher asked about it, that they believe there will be a review, but it's not confirmed. And it's tough because... Listen, you all owe this man an enormous debt. You know, he kept literary journalism alive in Philadelphia for a quarter century or more. It is not there any longer. Now we'll switch to this other topic. I'll give you a brief example. When my last book came out, the biography of Whitaker Chambers, and it was the first consequential thing I'd done, and I was a younger person then, and all the reviews really mattered to me, and I think I counted something like 150, including in British publications, when the book had been published there. If there are 10 newspaper reviews of this book, I will be surprised. That is how little remains. And it really is sobering. Some friends of mine in publishing have said, this book, which is doing moderately well, it's finding some readers, is being sold on television and radio, which is, for guys like us, it's really hard to fathom. You know? So that's a big, big change.
Well, I'm going to try to set you up with some people who didn't get reviewed in the Sunday Times Book Review, so you can go out drinking with
them.
Share complaints. Right. I didn't get reviewed in the Sunday Times either. Let's open it up to questions. Questions out there in the audience for Sam? If you don't, I'll start asking myself. Go ahead.
There was a large crowd in Washington, D.C.
Oh, right. And we're supposed to kind of kill time while I hear it comes.
Thanks for that reminder.
Large crowd in Washington, right?
Yeah,
the march.
There was a large crowd in Washington, D.C. this last weekend.
Did everyone hear this? Okay.
There was a...
That's it.
Okay. There was a large crowd in Washington, D.C. this past weekend, and it seemed... Well, I don't know who organized it. Do you have some idea about... who these people were and what they're really saying, and whom are they following?
You mean the demonstrators, the marchers themselves? Let me give you my very bizarre take on that, which I offer only in the most speculative way. Okay, I think it's a mistake, first of all, to think that they are being manipulated and controlled and being told what to do. Because this is often what the right says about the left. You have to assume if people are really anxious and upset, they're anxious and upset. And it may be that some talk show or television personality gives them a vocabulary they don't have, and they get a phrase like death panel and they're off and running. But I was going to say a couple of things about that. One is we as a culture have been historically so focused on the very young that we forget we have a strong, important, absolutely dedicated group of voters who are much older. And so here's some things I'm going to throw out that many of you here probably know. You probably know Carlin. Do you know who the one demographic group that did not, in age terms, vote, that specifically voted against Obama in the last election was the elderly, okay? And they actually compose, I think, a more important component of our electorate than we think about. And here's some little details. Let's say you are 65 now, okay? That means you were born in 1944. That means you were 10 years old when the Brown decision was handed down by the Supreme Court. It means you were 15 years old when Hawaii actually became a state. It means you were 27 years old. You were 17 years old when the great charismatic young president, John F. Kennedy, said, we all remember that he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. He also said, we're engaged in a twilight struggle against the forces of darkness. My point here is, there are Americans who have a very strong, vivid memory of a much different country from the one they live in now. And I think that's why when the Glenn Becks and people like that talk about communism and socialism, I was mystified like everybody else when all this happened. Why are they using terms when there's no communist China, there's no Soviet Russia? How can these terms have any resonance? Well, if you've lived, experienced a certain amount of history, they do have some resonance. It's not to say that he's right to use it, and it's not to say that he, in some Pavlovian way, he's triggering these memories. But what we kind of tend to forget is just how dramatic the transformation has been with the election of this president, because there was that great era of good feeling that lasted a couple of months after, and it seemed the country had crossed a new threshold. But as I say it in this book about an earlier period in our history, the currents of disquiet and anxiety are always there. They may be below the surface, but they will come up. Now, here's the other thing I'd like to add to that. We're getting two very different messages about who the marchers were. I was just interviewed today by a very conservative talk show host, Hugh Hewitt. Does anyone know his name? Mm. Well, his idea of who the marchers are is that these are true conservatives. These are small government libertarians who are saying, enough, you can't take a country away from us. Well, then there are others who will say, like the Washington Post said today, many in the crowd were carrying posters with Obama portrayed as Hitler and all the rest. So there's a kind of cognitive dissonance. We're looking at this thing and seeing different symbols. And that shows you the complexity of the country. So my not very incisive answer to your question is, I don't think we really know who they all are. And many of them seem to be just very ordinary people who are worried. Let me add just one little piece to that. The same group of, again, strictly in demographic terms, and it includes many in middle age, too, who are very upset about the change in Medicare, were the same people who told George Bush, you're not taking our Social Security away. Remember that? There was an outcry then, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, when I was interviewed again by Hewitt, he said, well, those Democrats in Congress wouldn't let George Bush do it. I said, it wasn't the Democrats in Congress. It was Republican congressmen hearing from their concerned constituents. Mm-hmm. And Obama, in an odd way, has run up against the same resistance George Bush met, although they're trying to do mirror opposite things. Mm-hmm. It shows you, to some extent, I think, how dependent we really have become on our government. We are, to some extent, wards of this great state, and we worry. So when, you know, it's easy, some liberal commentators have said, oh, look at those fools who say, the government's not going to take my Medicare away. Ha, ha, ha. Don't they know Medicare is a government program? Aren't they stupid? But that's not really what these people are saying. What these people are saying is they are so dependent on the government That if the government takes away this program and gives them another one, maybe it's one that won't be as good. They're mm-hmm. really acknowledging their dependency. Mm-hmm. And I think we have not worked through that as a society, what the relationship is between the government mm-hmm. and ourselves and the independent society. And this is something that some very brilliant writers, including Richard Goodwin, mm-hmm. you know, the husband of Doris Goodwin, who was the whiz kid in the Kennedy administration in the early 60s, saw as a problem in our culture. He wrote about it in 1967. Mm-hmm. He said, we expect too much of our government. We expect it to fix the economy. We expect it to provide the jobs. We expect it to win the wars. And we're placing too great a burden on it. And that may be the moment we've reached now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'll try to be shorter. That was such a great question. There's so much in it.
No. Back there?
And here comes the microphone. Somebody told me if you're really good at this, you fill in all the empty spaces when they're past the microphone around. But we'll try. All right.
Good evening. I've been coming to these lectures probably since they began. This is the first time I've ever asked a question, and so this is a really big moment for me.
We're with you. We're together.
Thank you. I have a question for you because I am a liberal, and very much so, probably I mean left of being a liberal. So I'm interested in what you have to say, because a good friend once told me you have to know what your enemy is saying. So I was curious about what you would say. But I disagree with you, and I would just like you to give me a reason why I should agree sort of with you, or at least believe what you say. I disagree when you say that the people who are saying keep the government out of my Medicare are really saying something else. I really don't think they are. I think the people who are being whipped into a frenzy by people like Rush Limbaugh are not people who are well-educated. They're not people who take the time to really carefully read about the issues. And so I think there are people who don't even realize that Medicare is a government program. And people like Rush Limbaugh are taking advantage of those people by saying those trigger words that make them come out into the streets with no real understanding of what it is they're marching for. And I understand what you're saying, that people like Mr. Buckley was more of an intellectual, more of an idea person, and I respect your opinion on that, and I think you're probably right. But who are the people who, because I see Republicans now as someone who's always been a liberal, as not particularly well-educated, who are just following these ranters who happen to have a voice on the radio?
I think the problem with that analysis is that I think most of us are not as well educated in any and all of these issues as we could be, and that begins with me. So I'm not sure it's a fruitful or a finally productive way to look at our politics as being divided between those who are educated and knowledgeable and those who are not. And I'll say a little bit more about that. There are a few sort of formulas that I've developed, and they may be totally erroneous over the years, by writing about conservatives and conservatism. And it's interesting, by the way, when you say you want to know what the enemy has to say, because I've written a book in which I'm being called the enemy by the conservatives, but I'm used to this. But here's the point I want to make, is that there are certain temperamental differences, I think, that inhibit both liberalism and conservatism. I think the temperamental dysfunction of conservatism historically, the last half century, three quarters of a century, is its resistance to new ideas. Okay? To the problem, the corollary or countervalent problem with liberalism is the assumption that their ideas are actually inherently better and maybe even more virtuous. And the problem with that is it creates a liberal mentality that kind of expects that if only people knew better, they would agree with you. And I think this is actually what has hampered liberals a lot. I think sometimes it has hampered our president, who is an excellent writer, the best writer we've had as a president in a long time, magnificent orator, I mean the best in a generation or two, and a pretty good seminar professor. But you know what he's not good at yet, what he hasn't proved he's good at, is retail politics. A much better president at retail politics was Bill Clinton, and he couldn't sell health care. Here's the difference between what Barack Obama does and Bill Clinton does. I happened to be in Denver for the Democratic nomination, the convention. And if you were there, actually I was just watching it on the TV, couldn't even get into the, you know, the auditorium. The best speech by far was Bill Clinton's. And does anybody remember Paul Krugman's column right afterward? He said what Clinton had done was actually take, like, the latest congressional budget report and transform it into a narrative. He had taken numbers and statistics and turned it into a story. And so he would say, just half paraphrasing and inventing, if you're making $60,000 a year or less now, do you realize you're worse off than you were back when I was president? That here are the things you can't buy, that you can't cover yourself with your medical insurance? Do you realize where this economy will take you? And then what does Barack Obama tell us much of the time? He says, well, we have to look after the middle class. He sounds like a sociologist or an anthropologist. Now, we may admire that in him. The problem is, politics is its own art form. And if you can't find the political language to connect with a broad base of people, which is what you have to do in a democracy with 300 million people, some 1 or 2% of whom identify themselves as being ideological at all. There are people who call themselves, who think they're conservatives, who are in favor of a revised health care plan. They don't even think in these categories. Now, you can say, well, they're not very smart and they should know better, or you can do what Hannah Arendt said Socrates should have done, which is to listen to the things the people around you say, however uneducated they may be, and try to figure out what it is they're anxious about, what they're hopeful for, and what their vision, however impaired or imperfect, a government should be. And then you're actually performing your political office a little better. And I think a liberalism that begins with the perception, constantly reinforced, that Republicans or conservatives are just not very well-educated people being whipped into a frenzy by the Limbaughs and Glenn Becks is just not going to work as politics, which makes it unliberal, because the liberalism, the classic liberalism of our era, is pragmatism. It's consensus pragmatism. How do you build a consensus, which literally means, right, it derives from the Latin word for census, counting all the heads in the room, seeing where the majority of them come together. That is the liberalism of Franklin Roosevelt, of Jack Kennedy, of Lyndon Johnson, through Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. If you begin with the idea that there's a massive part of the population that is already outside the argument, you're actually betraying a central liberal premise. So I would rethink that one. Yes.
We have one person in the middle here, and then this then fellow over there.
Yeah, okay. You're also patient. The last time I did a public thing in Washington, mm-hmm. Barack Obama was addressing mm-hmm. Congress on health care, and that 17-year-old was playing a quarterfinal match in the mm-hmm. Open. And they were like, nobody there. I didn't blame them. I didn't want to be there.
I'm sorry. Ma'am, were you going to ask this question, or is he going to... Oh, I thought we were going to go with her first and then you, if that's okay.
I'm going to be much more impudent.
Oh, okay. Just, I thought as a matter of politeness there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Personally, I am absolutely appalled because I keep seeing in all of these tea parties and whatever kinds of gatherings they are, they keep on using the Holocaust, anything to do with the Holocaust, and I'm very saddened by it because we know that there's no relationship here. What is your opinion about
this? It's appalling. But do you want to say more than
no,
that?
No, I want your opinion.
But can I add something else, because it seems to be my office to do this,
mm-hmm.
That there were quite rampant comparisons about 7 or 8 years ago between George Bush and Hitlerism as well. And it never should have been said then. Now what we're seeing is you know, more appalling still. But the fact is, it creeps into a lot of the political discussion. Now, of course, it's an outrage. I mean, what it does is to desecrate the very idea. Absolutely.
That's why I'm appalled.
I agree with you.
It lessens the sanctity of the horrors.
Absolutely right. That's exactly what it does.
I'm delighted that I could say that in front of people tonight.
But and it also, people who do that, they delegitimize themselves immediately, I think, for almost everyone. So, you know.
Thank you.
Now we have our impudent questioner.
I don't think I really need that. I have a very loud
voice. Right?
No, they need it. They're recording it.
Yeah.
The world of technology.
Hello. Maybe keep it a little bit away.
Yeah.
All right, this is impudent, but frankly, this sounds to me like a university common room discussion. The situation is really a lot more serious. I was listening to Amy Goodman. I'm sure you're familiar with Amy Goodman. She interviewed a man who wrote a book. I'm sure you're familiar with the book. I can't remember the name of the author. It's called Republican Gomorrah. You're familiar with it?
Yeah, Max Blumenthal's book. Yeah.
It's describing, as I recall from her show, the issue of the change in the radical right movement between attacks on homosexuals to a man named William Schaefer from Switzerland, I think, who was actually not a homophobe, but became convinced that abortion is a terrible crime against God, and that the conservative movement shifted their attention from the 1940s concentration on sexual issues to the issue of abortion, and that conservatives are using crisis mentality in order to drive home their attempt to grab power through fear. If you're familiar with the book, I haven't read it. I'd like you to comment on that. I think that's a little bit more serious threat to this society than common room sorts of debates about Edmund Burke.
Well, I'm sorry that you're not... I didn't remember that we actually had a debate about Edmund Burke, so I'm perfectly happy to do it. And I'm surprised that you're uninterested in hearing about Socrates. I mean, if I guess what I don't understand.
It's a much more serious situation.
So to your mind, then, a political conversation that involves people like Burke and Socrates suffers from a lack of seriousness.
No, I just think the situation is similar to the situation in Germany in the
30s. Oh, well, now we have the Holocaust again. Okay. So I think your other guest may want to disagree with you. You know, it is very easy for you, the student in our common room lecture, to tell us about the situation in the 1930s. Let's look around and see where are the stormtroopers, please? Where are the Nazis, please? Where are the concentration camps? You're speaking to someone who is descended very directly from Jews in Eastern Europe. Well, then you know what? Neither one of us, we survived, has the authority to invoke Germany in the 1930s. There's a word for what you've just done, but I don't think that we can allow it on our tape, so I won't use it.
Okay.
Do you know who else? I'll actually give you an example. Instead of getting...
I'm asking you to comment on that book.
You're not asking me anything. You're actually being very aggressively confrontational with me. So what I will ask you to do is actually let me say something here. That there was a period when conservatives also talked about the dangers of a new Nazism. Does anybody remember when it was? Mm-hmm. It was during the student protests on the campuses of the Ivy League. Alan Bloom, the author of the book, The Closing of the American Mind, which was a kind of, you know, doctrinal manifesto for the conservatives of the 1980s, was similarly appalled by the specter of Nazism on the campus of Cornell, where he was teaching, all right? It's very easy to look around at things you don't like and elevate yourself by making rash historical comparisons. Max Blumenthal's book is an expose of the politics and tactics of the far right. There have been many such books. They're very valuable books. They have mainly the virtue of reinforcing what you already think. What I have tried to do in this book is to look at something different, which is a debate that occurred among people who were serious-minded, for whom names like Burke and Socrates were not simply invoked as a kind of satire to criticize somebody speaking in a public forum, because they imagined the very best of them, and only at their very best, that there might be a public discourse where politics actually would look back at the great founding philosophers and thinkers who created, by the way, the nation we live in, right? It was Lockean and Enlightenment philosophy that gave us both these two basically conflicting documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, that all the battles are being fought over now. So I think you actually discredit our politics when you present it as simply a kind of conspiracy conducted by anti-abortionists. Are they there? Of course they're there. But this is a big country. There are 300 million of us. There's a huge range of opinions, some of them very strange, some of them kind of crazy. But that is part of the conversation that goes on. To boil down, to reduce an entire founding philosophy that has shaped our country and politics now for a couple of centuries and more, is to do a disservice to the whole enterprise that we're engaged in. So yes, those books are valuable, but they don't have a purchase on the truth. They tell their one aspect of it.
And on that very eloquent note, I will say that I would be very happy if the Times gave you another section or two.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming.
We're no longer recording? We are recording.
Yeah.
We don't count it. The word for what you said is bullshit.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.